What's it like when one of your friends on death row is led away to be executed?
You have a prepaid call from
William A. Abura,
an inmate at the California State Prison, San Quentin. This call and your telephone number will be monitored and recorded.
I had to be a different police guy, which is the guy who walked the walkways of San Quentin death row and without a gang, without a group of people around me. It was just me.
Soon after you went into to be on death row, and you didn't really understand the prison workout system so much, but then he said, we're going to do 75 sets of it. To me, that seems extreme. So I'm wondering if there's a danger of overtraining, wearing yourself out so that you're...
That's actually funny. That's funny. I'll tell you why. That's a good one, man. I'll tell you why.
Welcome to Death Row Diaries. I am Matt Ralston.
And I'm William Nagura.
And today we're going to be discussing the case of the Michigan murders, a few different names for this series of events that took place in Michigan, as you might guess, in the late 1960s, also known as the Ypsilanti Strangler or the Ypsilanti murders. And anyway, it's one guy that was doing all this whose name is John Norman Chapman. So we're gonna get into that. I do want to remind everyone to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Death Row Diaries and check out our Patreon page. That is patreon.com/deathrowdiaries, where for a couple bucks a month you will get access to all kinds of bonus content that's not otherwise available. And we try and do an episode a week, and we mostly succeed at that. So definitely check that out. Bill, we're recording this. It is Easter Sunday, and not a big-time holiday for me, but what's the holiday vibe like in general in prison? Is there any kind of festivities, or is it just another day?
Oh yeah, man, we got festivities. There's a yin yang. We got an Easter bunny hunt outside, and they got little eggs, and convicts are running around looking for Easter bunny eggs and candy. Are you serious? Yeah, the difference is the Easter bunny hunt here, they're trying to find the Easter bunny so they can kill his ass.
Yeah,
man, this is pretty much a normal day. It's the final, the Elite Eight of the NCAA tournament. That's what guys are probably watching. There's really nothing going on here. It's just freaking prison. And, you know, I'm calling you to do this today because, well, we know that you don't believe in the Easter Bunny, so we're doing it today.
Yeah. I never did understand the connection. I believe Jesus was murdered and then he came back to life. That's a little far-fetched, but never quite understood the bunny part, and I don't even know if there is an explanation. I think I've looked it up before, and I don't think anyone really knows.
There is an explanation. Let me put on my Professor William Nogueira hat here. It's actually a pagan holiday. You know, the Christians are trying to get people that were of pagan origins to really bite into the whole thing of Christian thing and the third day of resurrection and stuff. So the Easter Bunny, you know, that's a pagan holiday. And they've done it numerous different times that Christians stuck a holiday, something to do with Christianity, in that pagan holiday. So pagans would kind of meander over to Christianity. And that's what it's all about.
Yeah, interesting. And of course, it's gotten a lot more commercialized. And
of course.
I mean, I used to get an Easter basket. It was pretty cool, but it had that weird, like, shredded paper in it and a couple candies, you know. But I just like everything else, I think parents now are spending, like, hundreds of dollars on their Easter baskets. They got, like, iPods. And, oh, man, I just dated myself. No one knows what an iPod is anymore, but... you know, they have iPhones and stuff in the baskets now.
Oh, no, let me just tell you really quickly, man. When I was a kid, my dad and my mom bought me and my sister freaking little bunny rabbits, okay? And it was a chocolate-covered bunny rabbit. And, you know, my sister put hers on top of the refrigerator, and my mom says, what do you want to do with yours? And of course, I want to eat the damn thing. So I chewed the thing's head off, and I love chocolate. So, of course, my sister, she would come to the living room every day and look at her bunny rabbit where the refrigerator was at, and she kind of sigh like, because she loved her little bunny, right?
Yeah.
So, of course, me being the little monster that I was, I climbed up on the washing machine, grabbed her bunny rabbit, and every day I would take a bite of the back of the rabbit. So she would be seeing the front of it, and it looked fine. Finally, like 2 weeks later, she decides, Mommy, I want my bunny rabbit. So my mom reaches up and grabs it, and when she pulls it out, it's just the front of it, the back of it's all been eaten out because I ate the damn thing.
Yeah, that's devious. That's
yeah, I was a rotten kid.
You got to tell that to the guys in prison. They'll be very impressed with that crime there.
Right? Put me in right in the fraternity who murdered the Easter bunny rabbit.
Yeah. Let's talk about John Norman Chapman, the Ypsilanti Ripper, I guess. You described this guy as a Ted Bundy-type character before Ted Bundy. He is a very clean-cut, strong-jawed young man, right?
Yeah, absolutely. He's also known as the co-ed killer as well, but we also know that the co-ed killer is Ed Kemper, who killed all the co-eds here in California. But this guy, you know what? It's 1967, and it's a whole different type of people running around then. This guy's clean cut. He's actually a student at Eastern Michigan State University. He is a fraternity pleasure. He's part of a fraternity. He is, for all accounts, a normal American boy. But he's got some issues. There's not a lot about his childhood other than that it was pretty normal. His method to kill is beating, stabbing, strangulation, shooting. He likes to murder and rape. His thing is also mutilation. He doesn't settle for just killing the person or strangling her. He likes to mutilate the body. In my opinion, there seems to be an underlying issue with rage with all his killings because he's a classic serial killer. He likes attention. He likes to do things to get people to look at him. So this guy's an interesting guy, and he starts off his crime spree at EMU, which is Eastern Michigan University, and his first victim is a young woman by the name of Mary Therese Flesher. And it happens on July the 9th, which is summertime, 1967. And this is about, I don't know, 5-6 years before Ted Bundy comes on scene doing something very similar. But she disappears from the university, and she's last seen walking to her apartment, and neighbors reported that a blue-gray Chevy was kind of following her. There was a young man, clean-cut young man, driving, and he would ask her something. She would stop, and she would kind of just shake her head and continue walking. In other words, trying to get away from this guy because he seemed to be harassing her. After that date, she was never seen again until her body was discovered a month later, August the 7th, by a couple of teenagers that found her body next to an abandoned farmhouse. And Matt, as you can imagine, a month later, the body's pretty badly decomposed and doesn't smell all that great.
Right, right. So this is kind of in the country, but pretty close to the city, right? So he can kind of, does he go back to the scene or whatever?
Yeah, that's really interesting you say that because, as I mentioned, he mutilates them. Really, he stabbed her at least 30 times. This is Because some of the stab wounds, when you're in a heated thing and you're stabbing somebody, sometimes you hit the same location as one of the previous stab wounds, so you really can't tell where the knife when it ended or if it's a new knife wound or not. So they're saying at least 30 stab wounds to the torso and stomach area. Her body was also mutilated because he cut off her feet, part of her hands, and she had been severely beaten prior to him killing her. And the beating part is what lets me understand this guy's makeup a bit. If he has a lot of rage for these women, maybe he doesn't feel adequate. Maybe he was not able to perform sexually. But he seems to have a lot of anger that he vents on the person. So, a couple days after the body is discovered, and I'll go back to this because this takes you a little bit of a different direction. People describe that a good-looking young man goes to the funeral parlor where the body is, and he asks to take pictures of the body in the coffin because he wanted to keep records of it for the family. Of course, they told him, get the hell out of here. He insisted, and they ran him off. They could never give a good description of the guy, except that he did drive a blue-gray Chevy, and it was clean-cut, and he was a good-looking kid. In terms of the crime scene,
thank you for using Global Tel Link.
Hey, Matt, how is it now?
Yeah, that's better. That's normal. So you were saying...
Yeah, so between the time that she was murdered and the time that she was discovered, there's a lot of action in the area where she's at. So let me explain. The crime scene suggests that she was moved three different times while she was dead. The first time, she was on top of a bunch of bottles and cans, and she was kind of hidden. Sometime during that month, the killer came back and moved her slightly over a few feet into an open field. So, in my opinion, so she can be discovered. Now, when a person dies and is sat in the sun or sat in the open space a few days, they begin to smell. So for this guy to have come back, he's a pretty sick guy. He's there because he's getting off on it. It excites him to be next to this body while she's dead and he can look at his work. He moved her, in my opinion, so she'd be discovered. And then, on a different occasion, he came back again to the body and he moved her yet again. This time only moving her like 4 feet over, hoping she'd get discovered. So it still took another, yes?
So he moves her again. Okay, I was just thinking that I'm assuming he assumed that she would be discovered, and so then he's making it more and more obvious, but he's getting frustrated because no one's noticing this, right?
Exactly right. No one had come about, or if they did, they didn't recognize that that was a body. They saw. They probably thought it was an animal, and they just didn't get near it. So my opinion on this is that he has an impulse, very similar to a lot of the serial killers we've seen in the past. And that impulse is attention. As I've talked about before, serial killers find their work, their victims, to be monumental moments in their lives, very significant. And although we can't understand their perspective, we understand that in the victim's life, of course, this is monumental. Her life was taken. But for him, it's more about him and about what he has done there. So he wanted her discovered because he wanted everybody to know what he had done. And it satisfies him. I still believe that he was there. He came back for two reasons: to discover, for people to discover her by moving her, but also because he got off on his work. He wanted to relive the moment. We've seen the serial killers in the past go back to their particular hunting ground in Leh, where the body used to be. I believe after she was taken out of there, he went back to that area multiple times to get off. And what I mean by get off, to masturbate, to relive it. And we've seen this to be a pretty common practice among serial killers.
So does the overkill, the extreme brutality, the beating, does this suggest that this was something personal with her? Like, do you think he knew her in some way, or he was obsessed with her, or do you think she was just wrong place at the wrong time?
No, this is a girl at EMU, so he knew her. He didn't pick her randomly. He actually knew who she was, and she knew who he was. This guy, he's a little bit different from most organized killers. He proves to be both. But in this case, with this particular young woman, he knew her, and he also knew the second victim quite well. And almost a year went by before he struck again. So the second victim, Joan Keel, this happened about a year after, and she was also abducted. And she was found relatively quickly. 5 days later, she had been raped and stabbed an estimated 47 times. And law enforcement learned that she was seen last in the company of a John Norman Collins. You probably remember that name, don't you? But Collins, a very well-groomed and good-looking guy. Okay, so cops learned that the last person seen with her was a fellow by the name of John Norman Collins. And we all know who that is. But him being the good-looking, personable type, after he's questioned, the detectives accept his alibi that he was with his mommy. And they left it at that. Which is really interesting that they took him at his word. So you have to understand now, look at the close in proximity. This girl is stabbed 47 times. She's found along a roadside. Her throat is also slashed. Now, here's part of his signature. So, as I mentioned before, we start seeing a pattern with this guy. She's also stabbed, as I mentioned, 47 times. She's raped. She's found along the roadside. Her throat is slashed. And here's part of his signature. He ties her miniskirt around her neck. And, of course, she is an EMU student, an art student, actually. And she was seen with John Norman Collins, who had been evicted from his Zeta Chi fraternity. He actually was living across the street from Joanne and where she lived. So it's interesting that this guy is such a central figure, and law enforcement do not really pay attention to that. And he was going to school with her, and he lived across the street from her.
So, wait, did his mom cover for him, or did they just, he's like a white preppy guy, so they just took him at his word?
They basically took him at his word, yeah.
Wow. Okay, so, and he's, from the outside, you said he got, like, evicted, so is he unraveling, or is he from the outside a relatively normal guy at this point, or is he kind of cracking?
Yeah, I think he's a pretty normal guy. There's a lot of guys that get evicted from their fraternities, or something happens at school. But for the most part, this guy is a pretty personable guy, good personality, good-looking guy, clean cut. No one's paying attention to this guy, and he knows what he's doing. He blends in really well.
So if we could, like, take a step back. During this time, right, late 60s, serial killers, it's not like now where it's like every other Netflix series is about a serial killer. Did people didn't really, this wasn't on people's minds. They didn't really know that this existed in the way it did, right?
Exactly. This is not a common practice. Serial killers are not running around rampant. No one knows really what a serial killer is.
Right. So where do we go from here? Is he escalating this behavior? Because there's no serial killer that really just stops at two victims, right?
Yeah, he picks up a pace. He does what serial killers do. Only a few days later, construction workers find right, really close to the site where Schneel's body was, they find a 60-year-old Maryland scalpel, and she's been bludgeoned to death. And this time, this guy grabs a stick, and he, well, to put it delicately, he inserts into a part of her body and leaves it there. So he mutilates her sex organs.
All right, Bill, I'm a little confused here about his name. Is it Collins or Chapman? Does that even matter? What's going on here?
Yeah, well, at the time of the crimes, he had a particular name, which was Collins. And, of course, he changed his name when he was arrested in prison. This guy was one of those guys, when he went to prison, he did a lot of stuff, you know, filing paperwork. He was always crying about something. He's a classic whiner. And one of the things he whined about was he wanted to change his name from Chapman to, or Collins to Chapman, Chapman to Collins. It was just a silly thing he wanted to do because it was his father's name. And now he wanted to become Chapman. I mean, it's just, it really has nothing to do with the story itself, but for those who were confused, because I said Collins and I said Chapman, hell, it confused me for a minute too. I'm like, what the hell? But it turns out that this clown changed his name. And, you know, it's funny because this guy, he is such a classic serial killer. And I know that sounds a little weird, but, I mean, follow me on this one, Matt. So this guy, he has everything that you would look for in a serial killer. You know, the first murder we talked about, that he, you know, he moved the body, and he didn't move it because the only reason he really moved it was because he wanted them to find the body. He was really caught up in the whole, wanted to be a spectator of his murder. So he kept moving it so it would be obvious and someone would see it, and of course someone actually saw it. And then he goes to the mortuary, tries to take photographs of the body. It's almost that if in today's world, had he been around, they would have caught him the first time, because he left so many clues and there were so many instances where he was seen with the victim, or he was the last person seen with the victim. The case of Joanne Scheel. All the law enforcement had to do was ask the roommate who was with her when she got picked up, who did she leave with? And, of course, later, it was bad police work. Of course, they find out that it's three guys. One of them is recognized as Chapman or Collins. The other one is his roommate, Arnold. And when the cops finally ask him, hey, what happened? He says, well, shit, Chapman or Collins, he insisted on taking her home. And when that were Ann Arbor, when that's established, and then the roommate kind of spills that, hey, he was very upset when he got back. He had a knife with him. obviously he killed her. And he's the last person with her. So it's a little troublesome now looking at this case so many years in the future, because we can see all the obvious signs that are there. Do you know what I mean, Matt?
Yeah. Yeah, but he was... I mean, there was no game plan or no handbook, I should say, for this kind of thing. So, I mean, do you think... See, it's weird to me. There's kind of a dichotomy, because he's not trying to get caught, but then he's not trying to get caught when he's doing this stuff, but then he is trying to have the evidence found. So that confuses me, although I get it. He wants to be recognized without necessarily being caught, but I guess what I'm trying to say in so many words is he was just kind of playing it by ear, pretty much, right?
Well, he was, but he was also, and please pay attention to this, that remember I talked about that impulse. He was basically a slave to his impulse. He had to do this, and he couldn't stop himself. And he left a lot of clues, which they would have discovered in today's world very easily. But yeah, back then, this was a new animal. Sure, we had other killers who had done things similar, but it wasn't widely recognized that, okay, this is a serial killer, and he does X, Y, and Z. We have to be looking for an MO. We have to be looking for a signature. All these things came later on. Although he leaves them, and they're really obvious. One of the things that this guy does as a signature is he always ties a piece of clothing around the woman's neck. It could be panties. It could be a coat. It could be whatever. He also has a very distinct, I guess if you want to call it, it's not a signature, but it's a trigger. So let me explain. Certain serial killers have impulse issues that go beyond just the fact that they want to kill. This particular guy gets very angry when a woman, in this case, most of his victims, say something to the effect of, because it seems that some of these women go with him willingly, and they're charmed by him. He's a good-looking guy, clean cut. He's the kind of guy that girls like. Well, when he starts to make out with them or mess around with them, if he discovers that she, if by some chance, is on her period, he gets extremely angry. It's a trigger. And one of his former girlfriends said that once she was on her period, and he found out, he got very upset, yelled a bunch of obscenities, and we see that in his crimes. Most of the girls in his crimes were on their period when he killed them. And in a lot of the cases, he also overkilled them. He beat them first, tortured them, mutilated their body parts, specifically her sexual organs, while they were menstruating. So this guy has a trigger, and it seems to be a woman's function, and it bothers him. This is something that is unique to this particular guy, and that's why I call these guys insects, because every one of them has got a little quirk. And this one here, in today's law enforcement, or today's analysis of crime scenes, they would have picked up on this right away after the second victim.
Right. But interestingly also, that's only going to be, I don't know, 2% of the time, 5% of the time. So that gives him a lot of, that would mean there's a lot of times where he's not triggered.
Well, but in very interesting enough, this guy, it's almost like he's looking for that trigger. Because if you look at all the victims, they're all brunette Caucasians. And all of them were found within a 15-mile radius of this place called, and I'm going to jack up this name, it's Washtenaw County. And each victim received wounds to the neck, clothing tied around their neck, and each of the women was, in fact, menstruating. So it seems to me that this is his trigger, and he's looking for that trigger. It's almost like solidifying his belief. And because of the trauma to the women, the torturing, the overkill, 45 stab wounds to the chest and torso, he actually, in some of these cases, put objects inside the woman as well. And one of them was a stick. In other words, this is a really twisted guy. And there is a case that happened in this particular succession. It was a woman by the name of, her name is Jane Mixer. Now, Jane's a little bit different because she was found in next to the Denton Cemetery. And it was outside that 15-mile radius. And there was things different. She was in Wayne County. She's a law student at the University of Michigan. She had been shot and strangled. And for some reason, her shoes and a copy of Joseph Heller's novel, Catch-22, were placed by her side. Now, this is a different animal. This is a different signature. It's also, it's a similar MO, and law enforcement initially thought it was this guy. In my opinion, it's not him, because there's slight differences. She was not menstruating. Although shot, there are differences in the actual MO on how he killed her. So we find out later on that another person, this is many, many years later, in actual, in 2005, a 62-year-old guy named Gary Letterman, the former nurse, was tried and convicted of killing Jane Mixer. And it turns out that DNA evidence linking Letterman to her was found. Now, here's a problem where this is at. Okay. Not only did they find DNA that matched Letterman, but they also found blood scrapings or samples that matched a convicted killer named John Ruelas. Now, this is interesting because, if you remember, we've talked a lot about compromised evidence. And in this case, I believe that the DNA...
You have 60 seconds remaining.
It was compromised. And, of course, we're looking at this through a 2020 lens in the future. But it gives a lot of pause to whether Letterman actually did it or not, because John Willis is DNA too. We had a case recently where you and I talked about a technician was accused of killing a young woman. He ends up killing himself, and it turns out that it wasn't him. So compromised evidence in the early 80s or 60s is a big thing. Let me call you back.
Thank you for using Global Tail Link.
Hey, man.
Yeah, so, yeah, that doesn't sound like the same profile just from a bird's eye view. I mean, also Catch-22, during that time, was like, it's still one of the best-selling books of all time, and at that time, it was like, everyone had a copy of it, so that's not like you're super deep or anything, you know, that's just like leaving a copy of Wedding Crashers laying around or something.
Yeah, exactly. And when you first look at this case, you say, okay, this guy, we really don't know exactly what killers think all the time, okay? They can be on a whim. Maybe he saw the book, it turned him on, he thought, ha, this will throw him off, and he does something. There have been a lot of cases where serial killers do this. They stray from their normal MO to throw them off, or because it tickled their fancy, okay? They usually do stick to a particular plan. However, sometimes they don't. And we see this again, so let's move on, because this is an interesting case. At least for me, it's extremely interesting. So the next victim is Marilyn Skelton. And she's only 60 years of age, and she's from Romulus, Michigan. walked around with a bad crowd. She's seen hitchhiking in front of a shopping center, and the next day, they find her. You know, her skull's been cracked in three places. She's been whipped with some type of a belt or some type of something like almost punishing her, which is, again, here we go. It's very interesting how this guy, he believes he's punishing these women for something that they have done, either by just being women or because he deems them to be in somehow, shape or form, at fault for something. And it's very interesting because he usually kills the person, the young woman, somewhere else, and then takes them to a dumping ground and leaves them there. Now, this is an interesting situation here because, again, this guy is taking people he knows. This particular young lady hung out in the apartment right next to where Collins or Chapman hung out at. He may have seen her there and then followed her. So this guy does a lot of stalking. He is an organized killer, by the way. And he stalks his victims, normally people he does know or has some type of an acquaintance with, whether it be close or maybe just in passing by. But he does definitely find his victims in locations that he's normally certain. So the interesting thing about this case is that this young woman, again, she is in her menstrual cycle, and she is raped, and then, in this case, he takes a rod or stick, and he basically puts it inside her in a very aggressive fashion, like punishing. We don't know if it's post-mortem, or was it done during the time that the woman was alive? The girl, she's only 16 years old. So it makes this guy also a pedophile. So, very interestingly enough, very soon after, because now he's speeding up, a young girl, Dawn Blossom, or Blossom, she's only 13 years of age, and she is leaving her house near EMU, where this guy hangs out, obviously lives, and he was at school there, and she disappears. She is found very close by, in that 15-mile radius. She's strangled with a black electrical wire, stabbed in several places, but she was killed elsewhere. And then she's taken to a farmhouse, and she's left there. She is found, and it's like almost like now he's beginning to taunt police. This guy wants to do something. So what he does is he goes and he leaves her blouse at a farmhouse. They weren't there before. And then a short time later, he leaves other articles of clothing there that are discovered. Subsequently, after that, he torches the old barn. So, like, he's almost cleaning up, like giving them a ticking time in order to find what he's left. If they haven't, then he destroys the place. And this guy, as I said, he is a classic serial killer. This is one of the cases I've seen that this guy actually follows almost the Bible of serial killers, if you want to call it. Because this guy does everything that serial profilers talk about, which is the model. And this guy has it in every facet of what he does.
Yeah, classic in the true sense of the word. Not that there weren't guys like this before, but as far as documented cases, it seems like 90% of the guys after him follow the same pattern. And maybe there are others, that I'm not aware of, but in terms of like a well-documented thing, this guy is a prototype.
Yeah, and a lot of serial killers have followed this model, okay? And it's not a model like these guys go to school and read a book. It's a human impulse. And I've talked about that these serial killers are born, they're not made. And this, again, goes to that. If they are made, there would be so much different motives. There would be different approaches. There would be all these different things because each person is different. But we have a particular model when it comes to these guys. It's an impulse. And they do certain things. They get off on police viewing their evidence. They get off on newspaper articles following the case. They get off on returning to the scene to masturbate. They get off on moving articles and taunting police. These are kind of the things that make these guys tick. And they're not that different from each other, at least early on. And look, we had this guy, he was caught, but we had very similar cases. Alice Klum, she was 23. Karen Beeman, who was 18. And with this one, it's really where it really comes to the part where he gets caught because of, you know, the evidence against him. You know, his uncle is a police officer. He's in law enforcement. And he goes to the house. And there's an area where it looks like there's possibly blood stains. They check it. It's not. They run the samples they can. And as he's being cute, they actually look under the washing machine dryer and they find a lot of hairs. Hairs that they were cut from one of the kids' hair because they're getting haircuts. And this guy, this is the kind of stuff that he does. It's kind of off the cuff. But it goes to the whole taunting thing. The next victim, he puts a bunch of the hair that he found under the or on the floor of the garage or the basement where his uncle has allowed him to come in and stay for a while. And he puts those hairs in the underwear of his final victim that he's actually, well, they really actually, they catch him for that. You know, and this girl, Karen Sue Beeman, and I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, you know, she's reported missing. She fails to return to her dormitory. And 3 days later, they find her. She's nude. She's face down. She's in a gully. And look, she was extensively beaten to the face and body. She has lacerations inflicted everywhere in sections of her skin, almost removing the skin because she was hit so hard. Her skull was crushed. She had brain injuries. She was hit with a blunt instrument. And she had been forced to drink this kind of substance that burned her neck, shoulders, breasts. It was really something off the cuff. So he also stuffed part of her clothing down her throat, which were her underwear. And here is where it gets really funny because she was raped before she was murdered. Part of her panties were forced inside of her in her vagina. And these panties also revealed the presence of human semen. And there's also all these clippings of hair that were stuffed into her underwear and around her. And those matched the ones at the house where this guy was staying. But it's interesting because we know it's him, and we know it's him because he actually deviates from that 50-mile radius when he leaves with a friend and comes to California. And he goes to California, where he finds a young woman, Roxy Phillips. She's only 17 years old. And he kills her. And it's interesting because where he left the body, there was poison oak. And he's got poison oak all over his body. There's rashes and everything. That's where they tied this case to him. And they knew it was him. His MO was identical with Roxy as what he did with the other young women. And this guy, he just left such a trail for everybody to catch him. But if you look at him as an insect serial killer, you see the almost perfection in what he does. He gets better as he goes along. His MO gets better. He definitely has quirks. He kills at one place. He leaves the body somewhere else. He taunts. Everything here is classic, and that's why I thought that this case would be a great case to look at. You know, Chapman or Collins, whatever you want to call it, they convicted him of these crimes. They didn't charge him with a lot of these murders because back then if they had him, that was it. They didn't need to continue to convict him with 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 murders because it was a waste of funding. It was a waste of time. They convicted him. And I can assure you with a medical certainty, this guy is not innocent. This guy fits the mold so perfect of the methods of a serial killer that you would have to be blind and dumb not to understand that Chapman slash Collins is the perpetrator and he is the Michigan murderer.
Yeah. So did he become a, I want to say, kind of a media darling like Bundy? Because, you know, if this happened now, college girls, good-looking guy, Midwest, I mean, this would be a clickbait hailstorm, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, like Ted Bundy, this guy, he was about 7 or 8 years before Bundy began becoming famous because of the killings he was doing at universities, etc. You could say that Bundy had a little bit more flair to him. He definitely was more egotistical than this guy because Bundy loved the attention he got. He represented himself. He escaped and then went to another state, which unfortunately for him was Florida, where they have the death penalty and they actually execute people. And he killed there too. So Bundy had more of a media frenzy around him because of the escape, because of his antics in court. But you're right. This guy here fits the model of what we would think a serial killer may look like. Good looking, charming, clean cut, intelligent, university student. And he really does use his charm to get for them to come with him. If you recall, Ted Bundy sometimes just smashing the dormitories, he starts, you know, smashing skulls and strangling and killing like an animal. This guy is a little bit more, he has more savoir-faire about him. He's more charming. He uses that as part of his weapons to lure women to him and then kill them. Let me call you back.
So he goes to prison. He's going to be there the rest of his life. And you said he turns into kind of a miscreant, kind of just a prick, basically a thorn in the side of the administration. But I'm curious, did they used to try and kill serial killers in prison back then, do you think, like they do now?
Well, in California, they did. I can only speak for California itself. Back then, in late 60s, 70s, and 80s, and even today, a place like San Quentin, which is different now. Of course, San Quentin now, does it have death row? The guys are being shipped out of there. The prison has turned into a level two. They've really tried to change the entire thing. But back then, there was only about 5 prisons in California. There was Tracy, Folsom, San Quentin, Soledad, and there's Vacaville and a few other small ones. But the truth is, the big ones, Folsom, San Quentin, anybody with a sexual deviant case, meaning he was a rapist, child molester, especially serial killers, the code of conduct, it's called the convict code, dictates that if you see a serial killer, you attempt to kill him. And they don't want to hear that, well, he got away. They want you to kill him because it gives convicts a bad name. And this guy, there is no, well, he's not really guilty because, in fact, as I mentioned before, his uncle was police sergeant on the police force where the investigation was taking place. And when he had actually bragged to some of his friends, meaning murderer, Chapman, about details of how how the women were killed in a very grotesque way. He was almost told of these details. Well, when Pesci's uncle said, I've never spoken about these cases. So obviously, there is another link to him and the murders, that he had information that was never disclosed to the media about the killings that only the killer would have known. So to answer your question, yeah, this guy, upon entering a yard like the one I used to be on, they would have killed him within 5 minutes.
Yeah. Didn't age well, I'd like to point out. I always enjoy very much when good-looking guys who are jerks turn out to be ugly later in life. It's just something that makes me happy. I don't know why.
Yeah, and you know, I totally agree with you. I mean, these guys that do this kind of stuff, it's just, there's only one place for them to be, and that's some part of hell. But also, interesting enough, this guy, he also raped before he started killing. He felt he was entitled to the woman. And one woman actually had revealed that when they were getting into it, this is the 60s, so free love and all this good stuff was going on, and he was kind of groping her, and they were, you know, sexually charged. And when she, you know, told him, hey, look, we can't do everything because I'm on my period, according to her, he jumped up, pointed at her, and screamed, that is really disgusting, and threw a tantrum. Again, there he is. There is a bit of who he is, and he's showing it in other instances where he didn't actually kill. But you can see with the circumstantial evidence that most of the women, if not all the women, were menstruating when he killed them. It kind of shows you that, and that he also raped them. It tells you that he feels entitled. He took it no matter what. And that really does point to his guilt in all this. This, as I said, was a very easy case to find and point the finger at Chapman because of all the evidence that points to him and no one else.
Yeah. Well, really interesting story. I hadn't heard of this guy. We will be back next week. I just wanted to say real quick to the listeners, the phone systems where Bill's at are a little janky right now, so there may be some slight audio issues, but I've cleaned them up. But anyway, we're working on that, and they're working on that. And do check us out on Patreon, where you'll get bonus episodes and all that. Until next time, I've been Matt Ralston.
And I'm William Nogueira. Be safe. Be aware of your surroundings. Your life can depend on it. We'll see you next time.